Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Exposure to polluted soil, water, air killed 8.4 million people in 2012, according to analysis using World Health Organization data. More than any other cause of death in the developing world, and three times more people than died from HIV and malaria and tuberculosis combined. Many of the sources and industrial processes that caused that that harm are underreported. The U.S., of course, is one of the largest sources of waste. According to the UN, Americans throw away each year 52 billion cans, 8 million TV sets, 7 million cars, 30 million tons of paper, among a lot of other stuff. And that doesn't count the material and waste associated with producing and manufacturing those materials or the energy and the byproducts that do it. So today we will talk to our guests about the waste and pollution issues that they find most pressing, each with their specific area of expertise, and some of the threads coursing through the waste and research community that may still be undercovered by reporters like us. It's a pretty sprawling topic. I'm sure we'll only nibble around the edges and leave a lot of important things out. But we'll hear a bit about e-waste, about rare earth mining, about plastics and oil and gas waste, and some of the progressive efforts, at least here in the United States, that are meant to address some of the problems that we'll discuss. So the goal is to have an interactive discussion. I've asked the panelists to keep their introductory remarks kind of brief in the hopes that we'll turn to questions, mostly from you all. So if you don't have them yet, start thinking of them so you don't leave me on the spot for all of them. Normal SEJ rules apply. Questions to please are asked by members first. No speeches, not much commentary. Please keep it kind of brief so we can keep moving. I'll start off with by introducing Kate Sinding. Kate's a senior attorney and deputy director of the Natural Resource Defense Council's New York Urban Program. Her primary focus is on gas drilling and advocating for regulatory and health protections from drilling. Kate also works on advancing recycling programs as well as other waste and land use matters. Before joining NRDC in 2006, she was a partner in the environmental law firm Civ, Paget, and Riesel. Did I say that correctly?
No, but no one ever does.
Okay. She's taught environmental law at Columbia University and Fordham University Schools of Law and is a graduate of New York University Law School and the Woodrow Wilson School of International and Public Affairs at Princeton University and Barnard College. So first, let's hear from you, Kate.
Thanks, Abram. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm gratified that so many people are still here on the last morning, so thank you all for attending. Abram asked me to focus my remarks primarily on the issue of underground injection of wastes. I also have some expertise in e-waste, so if to the extent that that comes up in our conversation, I'm happy to tackle questions. But I'm going to start out here just focusing on the underground waste injection issue. Beginning in roughly the middle of the last century, industry started looking to underground injection as a way of dealing with its growing problem of waste, and specifically liquid waste, and what to do with them from a variety of industrial processes. And this was seen as a desirable, even safe way of managing those wastes, as opposed to having them in open pits and impoundments to put them underground where, at least theoretically, they would stay in perpetuity. Beginning, shortly thereafter, but certainly by the 70s, it had become clear that there were real risks and problems associated with underground injection. It was something that needed to be regulated. And so in 1974, Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act, which was designed to protect underground sources of drinking water from underground injection of wastes. And in 1980, EPA used its authority under the Safe Drinking Water Act to establish what's known as the Underground Injection Control, or UIC, program. And that's a program that establishes six categories of wells that deal with different kinds of waste products that are injected beneath the earth. Class 1 is the most rigorous, applying to hazardous wastes. Class 2 applies to oil and gas wastes. And then 3 is for mining, 4 is for shallow hazardous waste that's no longer in use, 5 is for shallow non-hazardous wastes, which maybe we can get to this in the Q&A, doesn't necessarily mean they're without risks. And then 6 deals with sequestration of, for example, carbon dioxide. The way the program works, there is a delegation element to it, which is known as primacy under the Act. And there are currently 39 states that have primacy over their underground injection control programs. They're required to have programs that are at least as stringent as the federal requirements, except in the case of oil and gas, which has a different standard as it does in so many areas. And in that case, the program needs to show that it will be effective to prevent contamination of underground drinking water. The regulations have gone essentially unchanged since the 1980s, with some limited exceptions. And funding for the state programs has been stagnant since the 90s at about $11 million, which is not a lot of money. Overall, there are some clear issues associated with the program, and Abram has done some excellent reporting on this, and these problems have also been highlighted this year in a report from the GAO. What's clear is that wells do leak and contamination does occur, notwithstanding what is supposed to be a rigorous and extensive federal and state regulatory control program. And that happens for a variety of reasons. It can happen because of faulty well bores. It can happen because of overpressurization, too much waste being injected too fast, because of what's known as communication with other oil and gas wells that haven't been identified in the area, and increasingly because of there's been a lot of attention on the issue of induced seismicity, earthquakes that are being caused by this high-pressure injection under the ground. But what's equally clear is that the extent of those problems is largely unknown, and it's largely unknown because there is a significant dearth of oversight at the federal and state levels in terms of inspections, and in terms of long-term investigation. And so there is a huge amount that is unknown about the extent to which we're allowing really substantial amounts of, in some cases, very heavily contaminated wastes to be pumped down into the ground, sometimes directly into underground sources of drinking water, and what those risks present for the long term. I'll just highlight three emerging issues without going into them in detail in the interest of time, and then hopefully we can delve into them more in Q&As. The first is the issue of oil and gas waste. Obviously, with the explosion of shale oil and gas development, that has led to a concomitant increase in wastes. And although fracking itself is exempt from regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act, what many people know is the Halliburton loophole, in common parlance, the injection of waste from oil and gas development is not exempt from regulation. So, as I indicated, oil and gas wastes are subject to regulation under the Class 2 requirements. So those are substantially less stringent than the Class 1 requirements that apply to hazardous waste, and that's because the oil and gas industry has received a blanket exemption from the definition of hazardous waste. So even though oil and gas development waste can be quite hazardous, they are subject to a less stringent regulatory requirement. The second sort of emerging issue, I would say, is the tension between the extent to which we're using underground injection to deal with vast quantities of our waste disposal at this point and dwindling supplies of current and future sources of clean, healthy drinking water. The Safe Drinking Water Act protects underground sources that have less than what's 10,000, what's known as total dissolved solids, or TDS. It's a measure of salinity. But we now know that we can treat water much more saline than we ever thought that we could before, either for use in human consumption or other uses such as agriculture. So the extent to which we're allowing those underground sources of drinking water to go unprotected or inadequately regulated or inadequately protected is a concern as we have ever more issues with drought, particularly in the Midwest and the Southwest. And the last issue is, emerging issue, I would say, is the efficacy of state programs. As I said, 39 states now have primacy over the under injection control programs in their states. Many of them are not doing an adequate job of regulation, and one of the things that the GAO report from earlier this year reported was that EPA has not been keeping up in terms of taking what state requirements do exist, including to the extent that they're trying to better regulate, and putting them into federal law. So there's a lack of federal enforcement when the states aren't adequately enforcing, even when EPA might want to step in. And so just two recent developments involve a petition that NRDC put in and then one that other groups put in for EPA to actually take over, reassume control over the programs in West Virginia and Ohio. So I'll stop there.
quick question before we move on. I know I'm the one that asked you to talk about injection wells, but give us context to the extent that you have perspective. Injection of waste in general, of oil and gas waste, is how important in the broader spectrum of waste and pollution issues that we look at around the world?
Well, you mean in the oil and gas context or more broadly?
Overall, how important an issue is it in the spectrum of things that you look at?
I'm not sure I can answer that directly. What I'll say is, and I'll answer it in the context of oil and gas waste, but I think it has more general applicability. Basically, when you're looking at a lot of these waste streams, you're dealing with a menu of unappetizing choices in terms of what you do with them. Do you put them in above-ground storage pits, as we've done traditionally, where you worry about leaks, overflowing, access by human beings or livestock? Do you send them to wastewater treatment facilities and hope that they can be adequately cleaned up and then discharged into our surface drinking water bodies? Do you do recycling, and to what extent is recycling of water available? That's obviously the preferred approach, because then you're using less clean drinking water and you have less contaminated water to deal with. But none of those are perfect. And so when I would say it is one of the many vexing issues when it comes to these kinds of waste streams and how to deal with them, and we don't have any sort of perfect solutions.
Thank you. Just to my left is Jack Caravanos.
Did I say that correctly?
You did.
Okay. Jack's an associate professor of environmental health at the City University of New York School of Public Health. He received his master's degree in environmental health engineering from Polytechnic University in New York and a doctorate in public health from Columbia University. Jack's research interests lie in disease connected to toxic waste sites in low- and middle-income countries. And since 2005, he's worked with the Blacksmith Institute, an NGO focused on waste and pollution, and in developing a global registry of toxic waste sites. His works included health risk assessments of e-waste sites in Ghana and Nigeria, including lead-acid battery recycling sites and air and soil sampling at gold mining sites in Bolivia and Ghana as well. So to completely switch gears for a moment, let's hear a bit from Jack about his perspective.
Okay, thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'm happy to be here and participating in the session. I was a little nervous as opposed to a classroom because you're reporters, you have pads with pens, and you're going to report on things, so it's a little different audience. Also, I want to say that I don't have my PowerPoint, so taking a PowerPoint away from a professor is like taking your pens away. But I have my notes. I think I will be reasonably articulate and won't disappoint you. So let's go. So today, I really want to talk about the global burden of disease from waste sites with a focus on recycling and what we in the global world call scavengers. How it's measured, what is it, the extent of the problem. But let me explain that we have a dilemma in reporting environmental health disease. Unlike an airplane that crashes in the South Indian Ocean, it gets tremendous attention. 200-plus people died. Millions are spent. Why? It's an acute episode. But that's not the case. In Zamfara, Nigeria, in 2010, some of you may know the story, over 200 children died of lead poisoning. Now, children don't die of lead poisoning. This is quite rare. It's a fascinating story. You should look into it. Hundreds more were poisoned, but it barely made a blip on the news media. And that's because of the chronic nature of environmental disease. We just don't see the bodies like you have in an accident or an oil well blowout. And we have the same thing in every episode. In New York City, every now and then, there's an odor that comes in from New Jersey. People go crazy. They report on it. And next thing you know, it's getting all this media attention. But in Bolivia, there's some miners. I just came back from Bolivia, and they're using mercury to extract gold from ore. You may have heard of artisanal gold mining. And they have neurological symptoms. They had no idea where these were coming from. And it, again, barely gets onto the global sort of environmental news network. I can go on and on about this, but it is one of our problems because of this non-acute event that we always struggle with. By the way, in this particular conference, we're doing a lot of environmental science, and the word health sort of comes in every now and then. They are, of course, linked, but I do environmental health. I care about climate change and trees and oceans, of course, but what I'm going to focus on today is primarily disease. So, and my message is quite simple. It's toxic chemicals from industry and mining affect the health of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people in low and middle income countries. And I'll give you some facts, and I have some reports in the back of the room. You could take those and read them on your own. So how do we know this? Well, about 8 years ago, as Abram said, I was working with a group, Blacksmith Institute. I was on sabbatical, and Richard Fuller at Blacksmith said, we need to do a compilation of waste sites. So we put together a program, investigators, coordinators. We're up to about 49 countries. We've discovered about 3,000 toxic waste sites, and that's just low-hanging fruit, right? It's not really a super comprehensive list. And we published the top 10, we published the Dirty 30, and on. But lately we wanted to answer the question, how big of a health problem is this? And that's where we started getting into quantifying the global burden of disease. Now, before I elaborate on global burden of disease, let me explain it a bit. You may have heard of Christopher Murray and Alan Lopez from the WHO. They came out with something called the global burden of disease. There at the University of Washington, and they came out with a, they came out with an index called the DALYs. A DALY is the number of years lost of your life due to a particular event. A simple one is my Uncle Gus died at 45 years old from cigarette smoking, a chronic three-pack-a-day smoker. He should have lived till 80. So he lost 35 years, or 35 DALYs. Now, you could do the same thing with non-fatal diseases like asthma. Asthma doesn't really kill. It causes infirmity and illness. And there's a way to convert someone who has 40 years of asthma into the equivalent that ends up being about 2 years of lost life. So this DALY unit, D-A-L-Y, this DALY unit is used in funding. World Bank, WHO, IDB, all these, GZ, all these international agencies use that. And it sort of measures the bang for the buck sort of concept. And that's what we did. So what do we find out? Well, we published some of these reports. And let me just give you some of the data, and it's in the back of the room also. So our data, we learned that hexavalent chromium exposure in India caused more DALYs than multiple sclerosis, more DALYs than Parkinson's disease, and more than various cancers, obviously not lung. In Indonesia, exposure to chromium and lead presented higher DALYs than upper respiratory infections, meaning the health burden from lead and chromium at these waste sites was greater than that of upper respiratory infections. And shockingly, in Philippines, lead had more DALYs than malaria or HIV/AIDS. Now, I'm not saying lead poisoning is more serious than AIDS in South Africa. Of course, that's absurd. But the reality is people attend to very noticeable diseases with serious outcomes and sort of forget the other things. And lead poisoning, mercury poisoning, chromium poisoning is our serious environmental, global environmental health issues. And they're not getting the same attention or funding. But I think that will change in time. Hopefully we'll get a Bill Gates that'll come to the rescue as he did with AIDS. But we're sort of working on that. So the question is, why should you care? And I think you most of you realize that just about everything you're wearing, whether it's cosmetics or jewelry or plastics, probably comes from some other country. I don't know how you shop, but the reality is our buttons, our leather is being made somewhere else. Now, the big corporations are usually targeted, right? You'll see Greenpeace will attack Nike, you know, because they're easy targets. But trust me, there are 1.2 billion people in India, and they need shoes. And they don't buy Nikes. There are local manufacturers that make that. India loves gold. Trust me, that's coming from mercury sources. So we really focus on those other industries. And the solutions are there, right? The U.S. has solved this problem. We know how to recycle batteries. They're doing a great job in recycling, and Tom will talk more about that. But in reality, the rest of the world is not quite there. And I have many pictures and stories I could tell you about. Maybe I will during the Q&A period. But the reality is the health burden is quite serious. So I just want to reiterate that the health impact from exposure to toxic waste sites rivals that of well-known diseases. With very solvable problems, very often the solutions to these are fractions of what it would cost to clean up a Superfund site. Right? Kate could tell you the price of some of these Superfund sites and how to clean them, but for less than $500,000, we were able to clean up a very serious community in Indonesia, Chinanka, at a fraction of the price using safe standards. So I think I'm going to end there, and we'll talk more about it during the Q&A period. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So your quick clarification question. The hexavalent chromium, the lead, are you able to tie those to specific products or items? I mean, what's the waste stream that leads to it? And in your overall experience, what are the two or three most significant waste streams or the things that we're all using or manufacturing that are causing the problems that you're studying?
There's no doubt that lead... from primarily recycled batteries, lead-acid batteries, is probably the number one environmental health threat on the planet. In the U.S., that's not quite, it's managed much differently, but lead is absolutely the number one. We've seen people break a few batteries in Senegal. They get a hold of four or five batteries, break them apart, melt the lead down, and lead now goes for about $1 a pound. Well, that's a lot of rice. That's a lot of food in Senegal. And the same thing is multiplied in Indonesia, in India, of course, and many other countries. And even in the U.S., we had episodes of backyard smelters of people breaking batteries, not realizing the risk. So.
Thank you. All right, for a different perspective, we'll turn to Tom Carpenter at the end of the table. Tom is the Executive Director of Waste Management Sustainability Services, a sustainability consulting arm of Waste Management, which is the largest waste handler in the U.S., serving some 20 million customers. Tom pioneered the company's consultancy, which works with organizations, communities, and corporations in part to implement cradle-to-cradle practices that encourage the recovery of materials and the reduction of waste. Recently, he's teamed with William McDonough to form the Waste Management McDonough Sustainable Innovation Collaborative. The collaborative is about what's next in recyclable packaging and products. Tom has an MBA from Colorado Technical University and a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Engineering from Trine University. He's obtained a green belt in Lean Six Sigma and is currently working on a certificate in energy innovation and emerging technologies at Stanford University. So, Tom.
Thank you. I'm going to take a little bit different perspective, and when you think of, I guess there's been a lot of talk and a lot of press on this theme of circular economy, and when we look at whether it be supply chains, whether we look at manufacturing, whether we look at events like this, we need to take that broad perspective and try to look at things in a systematic way. If we were to clean up just what we're doing today, there's still this backlog of probably 20 years worth of just waste and other materials that we have to deal with. If we were to manage them properly, it'd take us almost 20 years to get to that state. And what we need to do is take a step back, I think, and really start with that design phase. What is our intent with these materials? Do we intend for them to pollute and be these toxic hazards in the environment, or do we intend to kind of reuse those materials? And it really starts within that design phase and linking up through the chain, because what we really see is kind of almost this linear fashion of kind of passing the buck. And, you know, something's designed, and then it's moved to the manufacturer. The manufacturer moves it to maybe your local store. The store sells it, goes to the home, and then it's passed out the back end, and then it magically goes somewhere and it's supposed to be recycled. But if it's not designed with those intents to kind of break apart those pieces, or if it's not designed with the knowledge that's going to go in to help these third world countries of having the infrastructure to easily pull these things apart, it's really designed to be a pollutant out there. So we were really working at going kind of upstream a bit more, because we found whether we're working with manufacturers or organizations that care about the environment and care about toxicity and care about reducing waste, it really starts at the very beginning in redesigning kind of what you are as a company or an organization and other things, and taking that systematic approach. What are you procuring? What's coming into your organization? How are you going to manage those things? Are there ways of reducing at the source within that? So from that perspective, we really kind of look at that broad range and work with a number of organizations on that. When you look at e-waste and just the growing numbers of issues that kind of creates, there's a really, eye on that, whether it be here in the U.S. or just globally. More and more, every one of us have multiple screens. I read a statistic that most individuals watch television with up to 2 to 3 screens at a time. You're watching the TV, you're also texting, and as you get more and more into the other generations, that's on an increase. And there's publications out there that'll say that much of that is being disposed and it's being landfilled. But many of you, if you could think of at home, how many have a cell phone, an old cell phone or some other, e-waste product or something that's just really sitting on a shelf or in a drawer? Those items are out there, and it's because there's not that perceived value. And if you look at the industry out there, some things can be bought back, but other things don't have a value. So you kind of sit on it and think, can I use that again? And when we look at, the impacts of creating these materials, the rare earth metals and other things that are embedded within each one of these electronics, the statistics are out there that it's easier to recover the gold, the copper, out of these electronics, if you had a ton of that, versus, trying to mine that and all the hazards that are created, we have enough just in circulation today that we could eliminate some of the issues that we're talking about as far as in other countries where we're using kind of toxins and polluting the area or really, causing health concerns. But it's really kind of, driving the issue of value from an education standpoint, but then also kind of creating the environment to where it's causing people to want to kind of return and what their role is in the next step. Many people come to waste management and want us to recycle this widget or figure these different things out, but just like any business, there's economics involved in that. So there needs to be value of those materials all throughout. And oftentimes we're using materials or creating these hybrids or combining things that just can't be pulled apart. Or to pull them apart, it's very costly. And what happens when it's very costly is those things tend to be shipped into other areas of the country or other areas of the world, and the infrastructure does not exist there, but the cost of labor is low, and that's causing some of those issues. So waste management from an e-waste perspective really signed on to really working both from a private standpoint and a public standpoint, setting a lot of the goals and a lot of the regulation in place. While it's not hazardous waste, it's considered a special waste, but there's recyclable components within that, but there's also some very toxic things that kind of, are along for the ride, if you will. So those regulations really kind of, ensure that there's safety standards for the workforce that's involved with managing those materials, that there's a safe handling procedures, that there's ways of audit and assessment of those facilities. Because what we do see is that there's still, whether it's within the U.S. or other areas, there's some small startups at times that may not have the safety standards in place or may not have the economics. And the last thing you want is, this warehouse that builds up and is buying a lot of these materials and then all of a sudden shuts down, and then you have an area that could be a pollutant or a hazard in a community. So these regulations that we signed on is to really kind of keep the materials here, to manage those, but get those back in circulation. And a little bit later, I'd like to kind of continue on that theme of the circular economy, because if you think of all those points throughout that, we tend to work with manufacturers, the retail, the home, and all throughout that. But the collaboration that needs to take place throughout each one of those steps, and really kind of an understanding of how to recover materials rather than just recycle them. To recover them means you're getting them back into the supply chain, but you're also designing with the intent of recovering those materials and reusing those. And there's a pretty big gap that's out there that does not exist. I think as a society and as manufacturers at retail, I think we think that everything's circular and we pass the buck, but at the end of the day, many of these things do not have value. And most manufacturers or others really don't want the material. So we've really designed them to be nothing but landfilled at the end of the day. So,
thank you. Just to frame what you do, if you have a sense of it, I mean, when you look at life cycle environmental implications from materials, I mean, do you have a sense of whether of how the waste after use and after manufacturing compares to the pollution risk from the production and the initial mining and extraction of resources?
Yeah, I think you need to take into account that whole first phase. So when you're extracting those raw materials, the energy involved, the pollution that it could cause or the waste that does cause, if you look at it from a life cycle perspective and you re-enter those materials back into the manufacturer, that's where you have kind of that benefit for the environment. When you close that off and it's just landfilled and you're continually just not reusing materials that have value, I think that's where you're continually, extracting. There's more impact from a carbon perspective. So that's the life cycle piece that's not often thought about is kind of all that upstream value. And the EPA's done quite a bit of study of the impacts that does have. There's many things that have been benefiting from a lightweighting perspective. But if we can't continue to kind of close that loop, we're continuing to extract from the earth, those raw materials, and it's causing problems and risks throughout kind of supply chains within that.
Thank you. So let me start by putting a big, broad, general question to each of you. I think you'll each have slightly different answers based on what you spoke about. But it's about just the sheer volume of waste. So population is growing enormously globally. GDP, if we're, quote unquote, successful, our economies will continue to prosper and GDPs will increase, more consumer activity. Folks in India will all want shoes. Hundreds of thousands of new oil and gas wells will be drilled around the world. Is there a capacity issue? I mean, do we have systems in place to deal with just the increase, even with what we know how to do with waste? Do we have systems in place to deal with the sheer volume? To what extent is the volume of waste an issue, and what do you think is necessary to address that looking forward?
Well, yeah, this is the scary part, because we all see Vietnam and all those people on bicycles, but they don't want to be on bicycles. They want to be on motorbikes. And the people on motorbikes want small autos, and they want bigger autos. And all that means more batteries, more electronics. China, everybody in China wants an iPhone or a computer or a laptop. So I think it's really the tip of the iceberg. For the U.S., we're probably close to maxed out, though we'll always be buying more phones, but I don't think we'll see more computers. As a matter of fact, the desktop computer is sort of dying away. But globally, it's a very scary thought. And this is Indonesia, 200 million, 1.2 billion in China, and then, of course, 1.4 billion in China, 1.2 billion in India. You're talking huge numbers and huge resources. So the lead and the gold mining and all that will just continue to get worse. And so let me stop there and just hand it down.
Yeah, I guess I'm not aware whether anybody, there was a big effort in the 70s to kind of quantify how much more landfill space do we have in the U.S. When are we going to run out of landfill space? And that was really a lot of what led to the beginning of the recycling movement in this country. I'm not aware, that's been done on a global basis. And a lot of the focus has been more on some of the things that Tom has been talking about in terms of how do you reduce the overall waste stream. I think we're probably, as opposed to do we have enough space to put all this stuff, the capacity issue is more from a toxicity standpoint or a hazardous standpoint. I mean, it comes back to sort of the very, very many unknowns. And we're trying to do what we can. You know, people talk about shooting waste into outer space, rather than sort of dealing with the fundamental underlying problem that we're creating these huge amounts of hazardous waste, and how do we go about generating less of this stuff. We're trying to come up with more and more ingenious places to put it without really having a very good understanding of what the risks are ultimately. And to me, that's a very scary aspect.
So I think in the U.S., there's not the issue as far as capacity and so on. We've solved a lot of problems. We're also really, you know, advancing areas of, you know, new technologies, dealing with food waste or organics and so on. Globally, it is an issue. I think the infrastructure just does not exist, especially when you look at supply chains and kind of manufacturing. I was earlier this year in the city of Guangzhou and Wuxi in China. In Wuxi, think of the largest, you know, manufacturing complex you could think of, and then just, you know, double that, triple that, 10 times that. This is this city is just all kind of the largest manufacturing, and within that you have solar panels that are being created, other things, all great things for the environment, but yet there are waste materials that are generated within that. And the infrastructure that exists today to manage hazardous waste is just not there. Same thing when you look, in other areas, that infrastructure does not exist. And more as those populations grow and they're starting to use more products that are single-use products or disposable products. We talk about electronics. The average person in China has 2 to 3 phones, and they like new technology. And as things kind of come on, same thing with the automotive. You know, there was a company that we were consulting with in Beijing that was a great e-waste company, and they're starting to get into automotive destruction and so on. But your average gas station or utility places, they don't collect the oil. They don't know what to do with batteries. And that infrastructure that we see here just does not exist. So there's just this desperate need to kind of reach out and show kind of those best practices and more kind of advise on some of those things, especially from a toxicity standpoint, that does not exist. In other areas, you know, they're dealing with their trash, mainly in a waste-to-energy perspective, but the waste mix is very different. In China, there's a lot of food waste. In Guangzhou, people butcher their food from the store, so the waste is much more wet, so you don't get the BTU value. So there's other nuances that come in with that are changing within it and cause some of those dynamics. But that infrastructure just needs to catch up drastically.
How much waste in the United States is exported versus dealt with here with our own infrastructure?
You know, from an e-waste perspective, there's still quite a bit that's exported. There's also some recycling that many people have heard of, kind of the green fence within China that's opened up quite a bit. It was more of we in the U.S. had gotten lax on kind of the standards. I think that's up the standards, and it's actually for, you know, companies like waste management, we were meeting kind of those standards in many ways. It was other areas of the world that were, you know, stashing batteries and bales of cardboard and other things. In growing nations, they're still very eager for those materials and using that. I spoke to many companies that want the plastics and other things and stuff. So where there's those values, I think, you know, that economics of exportation of waste materials. I don't know a lot of, you know, actual trash. It's more your commodities and so on. And it just makes sense if you think of, you know, a circular economy or trying to get things back into the supply chain. Those materials, if they're being created in a certain area, you want those to kind of go back and create that circular economy. What's interesting is what's going to happen as we see manufacturing start to return to the U.S. and you have kind of this upstart throughout kind of the Midwest and down throughout the South. Can we start to drive and keep things kind of closer to home? You know, that's the big thing of recycling or composting or other things. You want to try to drive it to be closer, and you have pockets of areas. So it would be interesting to see if that dynamic starts to change.
And Jack, do you, is there accountability for the waste streams that, that you're looking at and the impacts that you're seeing? So if it's due to waste that's exported from the United States or from other Western countries, are there systems in place or efforts to either hold the manufacturers of those products mm-hmm. accountable or the governments where the waste is sourced?
These disasters that I mentioned about do get some press in the local countries, and Exide, which is a very large battery manufacturer, now actively tries to encourage battery recycling and will actually pay you, like the U.S., you get money for your battery. So we are seeing some of that, taking that away. Now, unfortunately, when you do that, you're taking money away from the families that have been doing it illegally in the backyard. So there's a double-edged sword there. But, of course, we prefer it being done professionally. But formalizing the recycling industry in the low- and middle-income countries is a big challenge I just remembered this one story in Hyderabad in India. Every day a group of family recyclers would empty a dumpster, completely lay it out in the middle of a traffic circle, spread it all out, you'd love this, sort out the different color plastics and all the recyclables, collect them all, and then put all the trash back. Every day this family would do that. So when you formalize an industry, now the recyclers are not making any money. So it is a bit of a challenge. In the gold mining world, we are seeing the restriction of mercury as the prime way to get mercury away from the small-scale recyclers. So mercury is used to amalgamate gold, and then it's evaporated away, burnt away. So now getting mercury in Bolivia is very hard, and you have to have a license to buy it. So keeping that away from the small-scale generators.
Any questions from you all yet? Do we have a microphone to pass around?
Hi, I'm Brian with Environmental Health News. Tom, I was wondering if there's somewhere in trying to spur that circular economy you're talking about domestically, is there a point in that cycle that you think there's the most opportunity, whether it's regulatory, company altruism, or economic incentive, or at a consumer demand level?
You know, there's a number of different just consumer product groups that are really interested in that, and I see them as leaders, whether it be here or globally, just in driving that and figuring out, you know, what's the economics within that. You know, many of the bottle manufacturers that make, you know, whether it's water, soda, other things, really are desperate. They'd like to really close that loop. So they're involved in kind of the infrastructure that exists. If you think of, you know, water bottles get a really bad rap out there, many of those companies want to get them back, but typically if you think of when you're drinking water, you're usually outside of your home. So the infrastructure, if that does not exist, you don't have a place for it. If you're weird like me, I hold it until I get home, and you know, if I'm on vacation, I have this big bag of water bottles or other things and stuff. But that's where it also comes back to kind of design. So when you look at whether it be pouches that are great from a lightweighting perspective but are made from multi-layers, how do you kind of close that loop? How do you work with each one of those? So there's many conversations that we're involved with and having a seat at the table. So rather than being at the end of the pipe, being involved with what brings value, it's going to be small successes because we have a long way to go, you know, things that are made out of multiple materials, toys and other things that, you know, we've worked kind of with Walmart to kind of identify the top 10 kind of areas to start really tackling from a design perspective and working with William McDonough to try to look at those avenues. I think it gets closer. There's certain things, you know, within beverage world and other things that just naturally make a lot of sense, and I think we'll push forward. But I think it's still kind of a utopia, you know, it's thrown out there a lot, but there's very small things that are truly going back complete cycle. There's great in the automotive world, they've done a great job of getting maybe non-ornamental parts. Maybe if you have like a rag that's used to wipe a vehicle, that's going back as a non-ornamental part, like maybe in a glove box or things. So we've helped kind of, you know, with that. There's like a fiberboard within like a Buick LaCrosse that was used as the dampening, the sound dampening within that that didn't have value before. So there's small success stories like that, but it's not this reuse economy that you see, but you see things like Yertle and other things popping up that are hopeful. I think there's not going to be a quick – most people want a solution. You know, how do we get away from landfill, or what's that silver bullet? I don't think there's going to be one silver bullet. It's going to be a multitude of just solutions.
Many of you may be aware, I mean, there is also a regulatory kind of mechanism for this in extended producer responsibility, or EPR, and that's been utilized increasingly in this country to deal with products that either because they're a real concern because of toxicity, things like mercury thermostats, thermometers, mercury switches in cars, to some extent e-waste because of the toxic elements, or because finding the value just within the market of recovering the recoverable materials, the inefficiencies or the lack of inherent value in those materials precludes those kinds of things from happening on a voluntary basis. And so the idea here, of course, is if you compel the manufacturer to take responsibility for financial responsibility, ultimately, for the responsible handling of the product at end of life, in theory, that will lead to better design. I think we have there's a lack, a real lack of data at this point in terms of the extent to which those programs are driving design changes. I do think, and particularly in places where EPR is even more mature than it is here, Europe and Canada, it has contributed to more of a sort of generalized awareness of some of the things that Tom is talking about, and the extent to which there is a circle here, and that we're losing a lot of stuff when it doesn't get recaptured.
Would any of you be willing to speak to the carbon load aspect of the transportation side of waste streams?
Yeah. So you wanted to know the carbon impact of recycling or waste streams in general, or?
Yeah, well, as waste streams hopefully are going to become more localized and shipped closer to the end product, do you see that having an impact on the carbon load of the transportation?
It does in a number of ways, too. I think, just the sophistication of the recycling and waste industry. Waste management's investing in CNG trucks and actually installing fueling stations across the nation to not only use within our own fleet, but to be able to use, you know, other communities can use that. I think that helps because just from a GHG perspective, that's lowering our carbon footprint per vehicle, you know, by over 90%. By creating those localized solutions, I think, you know, as you move from waste to recycling, it needs to be local. Transportation, you know, from a cost perspective alone is very high. So that's really prohibitive if there's not localized solutions. So that's where you see the need just for infrastructure for food waste. It creates different routes and other things. What it does do, though, as you kind of create more of these routes, it does get more vehicles out on the road. But if you look at the flip side of that, versus the kind of the impact that it has, just the value of those materials just going to landfill is greatly reduced. Our carbon footprint's pretty complex. My team actually kind of pulls it together. But, you know, the lessening that you have from, you know, composting and recycling really kind of helps with that impact, and then that fleet is probably the biggest thing that we see out there. So as things are kind of converted over, you do see that kind of localized, and that's what Europe's done a really good job. That's what we need to do in these mega cities, like in China and other areas, is build out that kind of infrastructure. What's nice is, I mean, my dream from a solution standpoint is to still allow those that collect the waste, the scavengers and so on, to give them the right tools. But if you had companies that created kind of almost a campus that would manage those materials in a safe way and pay kind of a fair value for those materials, that would be kind of the ideal situation, that they're all bringing it back, it's managed properly, and then you outfit that group to really be paid for collecting.
Are you guys able to I'm just curious where you think we are in terms of like hopefulness. The e-waste stories that I've done have often been like, wow, we're really, really behind and there's a lot of crap going to really bad places and hurting a lot of people. I mean, are you hopeful in the progress that has unfolded over the last, you know, say decade, and are we moving in the right direction quick enough?
I met a company by the name of Green Spring Environmental in Beijing, China, and we're collaborating with them. We actually brought them to the U.S. to kind of do a tour of state-of-the-art facilities and so on. It was started up about 5 years ago. Two gentlemen, they were in the IT space, brilliant, went to Peking University, and they left that just because they saw all the e-waste out there. And they had no idea what they were doing, but dove into it and are doing it in a responsible way and are desperate for kind of the other solutions for some e-waste, but like, you know, batteries and other things. So you see pockets of that you're hopeful, but you also see kind of other localized companies that you speak to the governments and they have regulations and laws that mimic the, you know, what we see here in the U.S., but the enforcement's not always there. So kind of in China, they admit that, you know, sometimes they're a little lax on it and they know things aren't being done the proper way. But you're hopeful. I guess in China, they've always been big about GDP. They're creating kind of a green GDP to measure, you know, kind of the mayors and other things, their progress based on that. So there's hopeful pockets. I don't think we're moving fast enough. You know, there's this backlog, like I said, that's out there and exists. And as you tour those spaces more and more, you see, you know, really bad situations that, you know. What I'm hopeful is that we're continuing to design solutions. You know, we have a ways to go here in the U.S. still, but those solutions are really transferable. And I think the collaboration that I see, you know, just amongst companies, everybody's global anymore, and they're really curious about their supply chain. Many of the leaders are taking on that responsibility. I think it's moving in the right direction, but it could be accelerated.
Did you want to comment on that too?
Go ahead.
Most of Europe in the past has sent its e-waste to Ghana and Nigeria, and a lot of my work is in those two countries, and they go for the easy stuff in those two countries, namely copper. Copper is about $3 a pound now in the U.S. And what's a shame is all the old monitors, the CRT monitors, you remember the gigantic ones which were loaded with lead, have really contaminated these huge sites. So we have this legacy problem. And then we have this problem of the future, because the electronics are changing so quickly that by the time someone gears up to separate, you know, a CRT, they're now on a flat screen, and soon they're just going to be wafer-thin pieces of paper, you know, that you could put up anywhere. So I think that's one of the challenges. E-waste is technologically a recycling nightmare. You know, it's so complicated. But I have hope that, you know, there's enough resources in there and our technology will be able to sort it out. Maybe on a quick note about e-waste, you may have heard about 35 smartphones, produces about 1 gram of gold, 28 grams in an ounce. Do the math. It can be profitable. And Tom said it perfectly. It's more enriched than ore, but people are mining it. Anyway, but more and more on YouTube, I'm finding videos on how to extract gold from pins on computers. And more of these videos are using some really nasty chemicals. So the move towards recycling also generates this sort of home hobbyist practice of let me melt down and using, you know, hydrofluoric acid get the gold out of these pins. So it's sort of a, just when you think you fix this, now this one pops up.
And Kate, I wanted to ask you to answer the same question, but in the world of drilling, you can answer about the world of e-waste as well. I know you have expertise there, but I pun intended, inject drilling back into the conversation, because I know it's a very significant and emerging waste stream. Do you see hope there? There's been a lot of changes and a lot of increased awareness about what to do with the various waste streams from oil and gas production. Anything to be positive about there?
I guess I'll start by saying I'm always hopeful. I couldn't be in my line of work if I weren't always hopeful. And e-waste is actually an example where, although there are major problems, and the CRT problem is a huge problem right now in the U.S., we're being flooded with them. There aren't end markets for them. They have a lot of lead in them. The changes in the industry since I started working on that issue 8 years ago or so to today are really amazing. I mean, it was an industry that absolutely resisted at every turn, and now it's regulated. It's still a regulatory program, but the industry, it's something the industry embraces and knows that it has to do and is looking for ways to do better. I don't think we're quite there yet with the oil and gas industry. There are positive developments. Recycling of wastewater is one of them. It's being driven much more at this point by economics than it is by anything regulatory. Hydraulic fracturing uses huge amounts of water. It's very expensive in some cases to obtain that water, certainly to transport that water, and then to deal with the hazardous waste that's generated. And so there's inevitably an incentive on the part of companies to figure out ways to use less water and to recycle what they are using. It's still a drop in the bucket. And this is still an industry which, very much unlike the electronics industry, continues to fight regulation at absolutely every turn. It continues to dissemble about the facts, even when they're pretty clearly in its face. So that's a place where we are much more focused on, at this point, in trying to move to the solutions beyond oil and gas. We know we're going to have a lot of it. We know we have to do everything we can to try to better regulate the industry in the meantime, to push the couple of examples of good actors out there to be role models and leaders. But ultimately, unless we very, very quickly figure out how to ramp up the alternatives to oil and gas, I'm much more pessimistic about our ability to deal with not only the waste issues, but obviously the whole issues that come with fossil fuels.
More questions from you? Where'd that microphone at? They actually just asked me to speak up and ask your question without mic if you can.
Yes, the question is sort of on the exporting of hazardous waste. And some of you may know that there's a UN convention, the Basel Convention, that prohibits that. And talking about legalities, what exactly is hazardous waste is a tricky one, right? Because batteries sometimes do and do not fall into that. I think that the developed countries, the high-income countries, are very sensitive to that. I don't think you'll see that happening much anymore, though, to be frank, I don't have a specific date on that. But I do think companies, India, some of the low and middle income countries are definitely using those pathways and getting around the UN convention. You know, these UN conventions don't really have much teeth to them. They all sign and says, yeah, we promise to adhere to it, but there's no real enforcement, there's no reporting, so it's really very tough. But in the Basel world, exporting batteries, are you exporting a commodity or a waste? And it's a thin line that sometimes people refuse to acknowledge that it is waste. So I think it's going on. It's just tough. It's a tough watchdog. We need someone to really keep an eye on that, and I suspect maybe a Greenpeace person would probably know better.
Movies about waste and crime, like Gomorrah and Machiavelli.
I think they, my sense is journalists are honest, ethical people and have a duty, both a professional duty and moral duty. I think they have to be based in primarily fact. I'm sure they're, as Exxon may exaggerate their position, these firms, these shows are probably exaggerating the conditions there. But I like those because even though they are sort of extreme, they do sort of push us and wake us up. And sometimes, you know, we need to see that. So a strong documentary on what happened in Senegal or a poisoning event in Europe or something, that's, I see it as positive, even though it's probably vastly exaggerated. Anybody?
I mean, I have no idea the magnitude of illegal waste management that happens. I'm sure it's substantial. And I would just make the point, it is certainly not isolated to foreign countries. There's still plenty of it that happens here. Some of it gets prosecuted, and it's high profile. I'm sure there's lots more of it that doesn't. Abram, you reported on some of the measures that companies were taking to avoid failing testing on their underground injection wells, you know, right here in this country, and the prosecutors saying that they think this is rampant throughout the industry because there just aren't inspectors out there. It's not that the laws aren't on the books. They're just not being enforced and implemented. So I think it's very hard to quantify. I think we can be sure, you know, it's expensive to deal with waste, and the more hazardous your waste is or the less recyclable it is, the more expensive it is, and there are always going to be people who are trying to find ways around that.
And I think it's a difficult thing, you know, I think it's back to your YouTube example as well. So we want to create value in some of those materials. If you don't experience it as value, you want to just discard it, throw it away. So the more you increase that value, the more that becomes kind of a back-end kind of business, so you kind of create other kind of dynamics within that. That's where I think, you know, private and public partnerships, setting up, you know, a system to deal with those hard-to-recycle waste streams, and you know, that's where, you know, sometimes extended producer responsibility has been, you know, a very good way of just kind of creating standards and mandates so people follow the right procedures within that. But you do still see, especially in other countries, you know, companies that are just not doing it the proper way or managing it. And I think we just continue to need to push those good examples and create kind of the infrastructure so that businesses that are doing the right thing, that example in Greenspring or whatever, you know, they can thrive and we outfit them with the best technologies.
One other thing on that I think, building on that, so one aspect of it, obviously, that I highlighted is the regulatory one, the need to have not only the right laws on the books, but then the resources to implement and enforce them. There is a lot that can be done on a voluntary basis, and there are some really good examples out there of certification programs, for example, that have been established by some of the leaders within an industry. And, you know, there are good, very good, e-waste is, again, one of them, but there are many others. And those can be, particularly when you're dealing with international markets, those can be a really important way to implement and enforce standards where industry is really, in a way, self-enforcing and enforcing against the bad actors.
So speaking of bad actors, and Kate, you mentioned, you know, resistance to regulatory reform, and Tom, you're working with a lot of these companies that are, some of which are ostensibly resisting regulations. I wanted to hear a little bit about the challenges that you face and where do you get the most resistance. When you get resistance, what is it to, and would you be willing to throw any of the sectors you work with under the bus as far as, you know, which ones are especially bad or have the longest way to go to get to the level of sustainability you'd like to see?
I think from a resistance standpoint, I see companies, I guess, going on different sides of the fence as far as how far extended producer responsibility goes. You know, there's mixed results out there whether or not, you know, it drives the improvement or whether it closes the loop, whether it you know, whether the money actually goes back into the program. So there's resistance, especially within kind of things that have a commodity and stuff, and trying to push from a regulation standpoint. There's many really leaders out there really concerned, though, with, you know, kind of that supply chain. So those same companies that maybe be, you know, pushing kind of the regulation are adopting kind of things. You know, you've seen the announcements with Walmart and kind of the closed loop fund. So, you know, getting that infrastructure out there. So I think it's a matter of, and I think just like my kids, I try to, you know, guide them in a certain way. But if I put a rule in place, they're going to fight me all the way. But if I give more boundaries or allow them to make choices or decisions, I think they're more apt to do that. So I can't really throw anybody under the bus because I've seen some hopeful things within that. I could see the reasoning behind that. I think the biggest thing is within kind of sustainability or within other things or, you know, environmental, it tends to take a back seat oftentimes. You need to kind of continually pull in that business case and some of those intangible things of value or kind of those broader kind of scopes of risk or you know, risk from a commodity standpoint or just kind of an impact from a social standpoint, companies are having trouble pulling that together. And it's, I'm finding those leaders in those spaces are constantly trying to justify either the existence of their role or the existence of a kind of a program. And it's a shame because from a marketing standpoint, that same kind of feel-good aspect, you know, your marketers don't tend to have the same kind of scrutiny under their budgets and so on. So I think that's been the kind of the difficulty is kind of justifying it because everybody agrees that it's not only kind of good for the brand, but there are those success stories that are driving business value and reducing that risk. But again, I think it's rather than taking a quarter-to-quarter perspective, it's taking that systematic approach, maybe decoupling from Wall Street at times and really saying, like Unilever, you know, we're going on this path.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the type of mining?
Rare earths.
Oh, rare earths mining, okay. No. no, we are so overwhelmed with gold mining and lead and to some extent chromium mining to produce chromium ore for tanning of leather that this is not blacksmith, nor in my research or working with blacksmith have we really touched on that yet. So it's fertile ground for investigation, for sure.
And my apologies for overpromising.
Oh.
I'm Jeff Kaiser with the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries in Washington. We've all heard about these very sad tales of pollution in these third world countries, but doesn't it all get down to economic development and education? I mean, how can you expect lead recyclers in Ghana recycle a battery correctly when they don't have a secondary lead smelter anywhere in the country to do it, or know what the hazards are because they've not gone through a proper education in our standards. So, I mean, how do you go about fixing these pollution problems through a bigger picture of economic development in these countries and education?
And it is a good question, and I'll answer and then I'll hand it over to Tom. I find that for the manufacturers that we deal with, which are at a different scale from what Tom, I think, is dealing with, they want to do the right thing. So very often they just don't realize that it's so toxic and they don't realize there are some simple things to do to prevent poisoning, washing your hands, washing your feet before you go to bed, eating a healthy diet. Anyway, on and on. So that when we do confront them with the numbers, the blood lead levels, they generally are shocked and ashamed and do change. And we have some success stories with, you know, behavioral changes. I think the real key is children, is educating children early on and educating teachers so that the next generation will see and be able to recognize this hazard. Because so often it just comes back. You know, you clean up one community, another generation comes along, and they go right back to what they were doing. So to get sustainable improvements, I think you need to get to the educators. One problem we have is you would think this is a Ministry of Health issue, but they're so overwhelmed in infectious disease and HIV and other, you know, maternal care that they are not at the level of environmental health. So we deal with the environmental ministries and very often the environmental mining industries ministries, and they say, well, you know, they're not health people. So it's almost we need to unite those two. But I'm always shocked in how many countries there's just no environmental health officer in the environmental, health ministry department. And very often they just don't want to touch it because they have so much else to do. So that's a frustration in the developing world, yeah.
I think it does get back to education, but it's such a low concern when those same individuals, they're worried about putting food on the table and just making an honest wage to kind of for their family to survive. So it's so low within that. I think that's where you know, the governments are seeing that kind of concern and they're getting that pushback. Those companies that are global are looking to you know, extend their responsibility and realize that if they're manufacturing in those areas, that they have a responsibility you know, to have a positive impact. So you're seeing some of that. You know, many of the discussions that we had throughout kind of China and their governments, they recognize those issues and are trying to build out that infrastructure. It's going to take some time. It's going to take some time from an education standpoint, but I think there's so many other issues. Even in China, you're dealing with, you know, the smog and other air pollution issues that, you know, even toxicity is probably kind of low on the totem pole as far as water and other things, too.
You heard the clapping next door. We're pretty much out of time.
Who've flown in from all across the country. It's a sprawling topic. I know we just got to touch on each of these issues just a little bit, but thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation. I hope you all did too.